Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work. And today I'm really excited to have writer-director Mo Perkins with me. Hi, Mo.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, just trapping you in this box during...
Just a very little box on the top
during
of the
earthquake
very
season.
Tall
For those of you who aren't as familiar with Mo's work, please let me give you an introduction. Mo earned an MFA in directing from UCLA's School of Film and Television. Her master's thesis film, Piss Hat.
Just let that sit there for a while.
was nominated for a Student Academy Award. She has been the recipient of numerous awards, including the Dorothy Arzner Award for Women Directors, the Wasserman Award, and the MPAA Award. As a writer-director, Mo has worked in almost every genre, comedy, musical comedy, drama, horror, and sci-fi. Let's get some action in there, girl.
I'm working on it.
Okay. Her writer-directorial debut feature was an independent film called A Quiet Little Marriage, starring Mary Elizabeth Ellis, Cy Carter, Jimmy Simpson, Michael O'Neill, Charlie Day, and Melanie Linsky. On the festival circuit, it won many awards, including the Grand Jury Prize at Slamdance, and it was distributed by IFC. Her second feature film was a comedy called The Last Time You Had Fun, starring Dimitri Martin, Eliza Coop, Mary Elizabeth Ellis, Charlene Yee, and Kyle Bornheimer. And we should mention that Drea Clark produced that.
Yeah.
People who listen to the show are familiar with Drea Clark. The film premiered at the Los Angeles Film Festival and was distributed by Gravitas Ventures. Most recently, Mo directed the second season, 6 episodes, of a romantic musical comedy called I Ship It for the CW. On the writing side, Mo is currently working on a witch show with co-writer Amber Benson, also another former guest.
I just stalk your guests.
I know.
And creatively collaborate
I
with
know.
Them.
Yeah. And shopping a drama series based on the commune where she grew up, which is a whole can of worms that you just end your bio with.
Just so much.
You're like, also, by the way.
I'm like, who is she? You can't guess from that bio.
No.
All the things.
No, from Piss Hat to Commune. So,
yeah.
Mo.
Hi.
The movie that you chose to talk about today is called Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, could you tell me a little bit about why you chose this one?
Yes. And I have a really specific reason. And it actually has to do with the commune.
Great.
Right, because that ties in.
Yeah.
I grew up on a commune where we didn't have film. We didn't have that. And when we left, when it broke up in the 80s and we moved from Tennessee to California, it was kind of like a big cultural shift for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were kind of tie-dye hippie Amish. Like it was a subsistence farming situation without houses.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I was transported to Northern California and going to public school, and it was acid wash jeans and cabbage like all this. We didn't have money. So what my sister and I used to do.
Not having money when you're going to school in the 80s is a very interesting time, because the 80s is a lot about money.
It's so much money, but also like not only not having money, but like we had no money growing up. Like there was no currency. It was a commune. So we grew our own food and we worked on it was a bartering commune.
Yeah.
No currency. And then the 80s, which is all about money. So we were, it was like, even though we were American, it was an immigrant experience to be dropped into.
Yeah.
Public school in the 80s. And what
an alien experience at some point, because like you have no currency, you have no concept of that. It's not the
we were so other
with
our vegan tofu sandwiches and our weird like used clothing from Goodwill, and we were other.
Yeah.
And so I think that partially just to catch up, we deep dove into cinema, all of us. And my sister and I used to take the bus from Forestville to Santa Rosa to the Cottingtown Mall.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go with our dollars and we would see the first movie of the day. And then like little delinquent thieves, we would go from movie to movie and see them all.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just stay all day with our one ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw Little Shop of Horrors and I just stayed. I stayed and I saw it again, and then I stayed and I saw it again. You know, I just, there was something, I was totally an anthropo, apologist at the movies, mm-hmm. and there was something so shiny and wonderful about that movie, and I just fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And even, I don't think that I've watched it a lot since then, but I think about it all the time, and the songs pop up in my head at weird moments, and I was probably 11 when I saw it.
Yeah.
And I've been dying to show it to my own kid, who's 10, but I'm, trying to weigh because there's some stuff in there.
Yeah.
So when we were talking about what do you want to show, I was thinking about the show that I just directed that's coming out in August, mm-hmm. that's a musical. And I was like, well, I Ship It is a musical, and I wanted to do something that was musical. And then I was like, oh, Little Shop of Horrors.
For those of you who haven't seen Little Shop of Horrors, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to stop this and watch Little Shop of Horrors, you can find that and do it right now.
Oh, do watch it, though.
Now, let's introduce Little Shop of Horrors. Written by Howard Ashman and directed by Frank Oz, Little Shop of Horrors stars Rick Moranis as Seymour Krelborn, a shabby but sweet loser type who works for a Mr. Mushnick's flower shop in Skid Row of Manhattan. And I put Skid Row in quotation marks there. He's had eyes for this beautiful co-worker, Audrey, played by Ellen Green, but has never had the nerve to tell her. Mr. Mushnick says business is slow, that he's considering shuttering the shop. But Audrey suggests, hey, maybe they'd get some business if they display some of Seymour's more unusual plants in the window.
Seymour, why don't you run downstairs and bring up that strange and interesting new plant you've been working on? You see, Mr. Mushnick, some of those exotic plants Seymour's been tinkering around with are really unusual. And we thought that maybe some of those strange and interesting new plants prominently displayed and advertised would attract business.
So they put a little plant Seymour calls Audrey 2 in the window, and it's a hit. But Audrey 2 begins to wither, putting the store at risk again. Seymour accidentally pricks his finger, getting blood in the plant's little mouth, and it perks up.
I've given you sunlight. I've given you rain. Looks like you're not happy, lest I open a vein. I'll give you a few drops, if that'll appease.
Seymour keeps feeding Audrey 2 his blood, and the plant flourishes. But Seymour's energy is totally drained. Audrey's involved with Orin the dentist, meanwhile, and he's abusing her, but she secretly dreams of running away with Seymour.
I know Seymour's the greatest, but I'm dating a semi-sadist. So I got a black eye and my arm's in a cast. Still, that Seymour's the cutie. But what if not, he's gone in the beauty.
If only each of those two people had the nerve to confess their secret loves. So Audrey 2 needs more blood than Seymour can give, but she proposes a solution. Kill someone and feed them to Audrey 2, and Seymour can find fame and fortune as the plant's plant daddy. Seymour says no, but then sees Orin beating on Audrey, and then, you know, he's in it to win it. Seymour tries to kill Orin in his office, but can't go through with it. No matter. Orin accidentally kills himself by asphyxiating on some nitrous oxide, to which he is addicted. Seymour cuts him up and feeds him to Audrey, too, but Mr. Mushnick sees and runs away. Audrey and Seymour confess their love for one another, finally.
Suddenly Seymour is here to provide you sweet understanding. Seymour's your friend.
Nobody ever treated me kindly. Daddy left early. Mama was poor. I'd meet a man and I'd follow him blindly. He'd snap his fingers at me. I'd say sure.
But then Mr. Mushnick corners Seymour to blackmail him for Orin's death. Seymour leads Mushnick to Audrey 2, who devours him whole. Seymour does find fame and success with Audrey 2, but wants to run away and leave the plant to starve. Audrey 2 catches wind and calls Audrey to the store.
Hello.
Hey, little lady, hello.
Who is this?
You're looking cute as can be.
Is this someone I know?
You're looking mighty sweet.
Seymour!
No, it ain't Seymour. It's me.
Seymour rushes in to save Audrey from Audrey 2. He almost leaves the plant, but then goes back and eventually destroys it with some electrical wires, blowing it up. All is well. Seymour and Audrey marry, but there in the garden hiding is another little Audrey 2. And I should say that the synopsis that I just gave is the theatrical release, but it is not from the director's cut, which was a different ending that we will talk about.
Oh, yes. I haven't seen that ending,
but I know. So yeah. The darker ending was, it's kind of nuts. Okay, so.
It's a nuts movie.
Yeah.
Like, rewatching it last night, I was like, oh, okay, it's super problematic.
Yeah.
From today's lens.
Yes.
But it is a dark lens on humanity.
And it's kind of apt because I'm like, yeah, throw everyone in the pit, you know? Like,
right.
So in the ending of the other version, it is that Audrey 2 mortally wounds Audrey, and she pleads with Seymour to feed her to Audrey 2 because she's already going to die, and she, you know, she wants to give herself away for this cause.
Self-sacrificing female.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So she has fed to Audrey 2, and then after that, there's Seymour tries to jump off of a bridge, but the plant guy that Jim Belushi plays comes in and is just like, he talks him off the ledge. He's like, yay, we could like sell these, you know, I'm already going to do it because I already took a cutting of Audrey 2. So I'm going to sell these all over the U.S. And Rick Moranis is like, oh, no. And then, you know, fast forward, we've got Audrey 2 plants all over the place. And eventually Audrey 2 plants destroy the city, destroy the world, taking it over, eating everyone, and
we all die.
Yeah. It's very dark. And that was so that was
okay.
Ditched.
It didn't go over well.
Yeah. Okay. So what Frank Oz said was, quote, "They were clapping after every single number. It was amazing. What didn't go well was the very last part of the ending where Ellen and Rick were both killed by the plant and the plant won. It was 30 years ago. I think we had a bit more of a period that was not as cynical as we have today. So today it might work. But then that ending was not satisfying, which I understand, and Howard did too. We had no choice but to make the new ending. Not because David or Warner's pushed us, but it was self-evident because of the cards were saying, we hate the fact that you killed Ellen and Rick because they loved Ellen and Rick." We talk a lot about the idea of fan service in movies and things right now. You know, like, what is fan service?
Right.
But there does have to be some kind of
conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you should have your artistic integrity, but if the world is not going to like this and you're trying to get people to see all the other parts of this movie or the show.
Right. You're making your stuff for someone.
Yeah.
It's a shared experience. It's funny. That's what I ship it's about.
I mean,
yeah.
Can you talk more about
that? Yeah. You're like, oh, just drop that in the room and not and say nothing. I ship it is about a fangirl of a magical witch vampire-y show
mm-hmm.
on the CW.
Yeah.
And she kind of sneaks and wheedles her way behind the scenes and gets into the writer's room.
Mm-hmm.
And then the show is very much about, is the show for the makers or is it for the fans? And who should it be for?
Well, I mean, that's a meta conversation if you're also wondering what your show is for, too. Because
right.
Is your show for the makers or the fans? You
I
know?
Think our show is very much for the fans. It's kind of like a love letter to the fans of CW shows.
Is there anything wrong with that?
No, I don't. I mean, hopefully not. Right? Because it's coming out.
Because it already happened.
It already happened. Yeah.
let's just bring up Levi Stubbs, who,
yeah,
who did the voice of the plant, because he was selected, essentially hand-selected. There was the actor who was playing this character on stage, and then there was the idea of getting, you know, like a name person. So it turned out to be that when Frank Oz gave him the script, you know, because Levi Stubbs was the essentially the lead for the top, so he had this really kind of huge, huge throaty voice. Frank Oz said, he was exactly what I was looking for. Somebody who had an edge to him, who was real black, real street, who had a touch of malevolence, but could be real silly and funny at the same time. All I thought about was what an incredible singer Levi was, the passion, the subtleties, the variations, the humor he'd give to the songs, but never for a second about his being part of a singing group. So people were like, oh, you're doing stunt casting or something like that. And that's not what it was. It's just that he had personality, and that there was a difference in the way that they were talking about with Frank Oz, saying that you could do the voice and that's great and you could have a great voice, but can you act
right
while you're singing? Can you act while you're singing, and can you kind of have those intonations? You see, Ellen Green has that too.
Yeah,
she can vary, like, she can make her voice beautiful, but she's acting as she's singing.
Even breathing. There's that time, he's like, I named the plant Audrey too, and she does this.
I think it's some kind of fly trap, but I haven't been able to identify it in any of my books. I gave it my own name, though. I call it an Audrey too.
After me?
I hope you don't mind.
And I was like, oh,
yeah,
it's so good. And
exactly.
There's nothing else.
Yeah.
That's it.
And you wonder, is just like, oh, is that in the script? Is it, what, you know, did she develop
did
this
she
on
bring
the stage?
That? Yeah.
Because, and we'll talk about Ellen Green being the first person to reprise their role from the stage on film,
yeah,
in cinematic history, essentially. But,
oh, really?
I want to get into this quote that Frank Oz said,
Audrey,
because,
yeah,
you notice that I stopped at, like, who was real black, real street.
Yeah.
So this was the 80s, and we were having, you know, like, it's just not the way that we talked about race then. But there were charges of the smaller plant, the Audrey II smaller plant. The lips were modeled on Ellen Green. Right.
Oh.
And then the larger plant, they said the lips weren't modeled on Levi Stubbs, but the plant did have a kind of African-American almost caricature about it.
Yes.
And so there were charges of, you know, being kind of racist in the way that they kind of made this character.
Yeah.
But they said adamantly they weren't trying to do it, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't maybe like a subconscious kind of thing.
I feel like there's, in a lot of work, there's a belly of subconscious, like, that plant looks like a penis for half the movie,
yeah,
and then it looks like a giant vagina.
Have you ever had in your work, like, any kind of subconscious thing that you didn't know until you saw it?
Yeah, I'm sure.
And you're like, oh.
Oh, yeah, all the time that happens.
I love vagina imagery, I guess.
I love,
you know?
Why am I, or just even, like, why am I avoiding this scene? It's the pivotal scene where somebody is dying and I'm uncomfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just cut it out of the story,
mm-hmm,
and I Shakespeared it, and we all get together and talk about it after.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're shooting it and you're like, it's the fucking scene. Shoot this, you know, like, yeah, we.
But you're confronting these things that you weren't
necessarily
aware of.
You weren't aware until you get to it.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. When
okay.
we come back, I want to continue on with a little bit of Levi Stubbs and going into the production. And you said something about, like, the detail of the production design and these,
yeah,
these folks that are kind of populating this weird world. And so we'll get further into that when we get right back.
Fairhaven's a city in a bubble, an actual bubble. It keeps the monsters out. Most of them, anyway.
I never liked the look of movies on Blu-ray. For my money, Betamax is the superior format.
I'm thinking of deleting Facebook and going back to MySpace.
As far as beverages go, I'm just kind of over water.
Though I guess at any given party, you're gonna meet some dudes like that. Even if you're not in the middle of a nightmarish wasteland. Bubble, the sci-fi comedy from MaximumFun.org. Just open your podcast app and search for Bubble.
Welcome to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Mo Perkins, and we're talking about Little Shop of Horrors. Okay, so back to Levi Stubbs. One of the things that he said is, quote, "I didn't really know what this whole thing was about. I'd never seen the play, so I had no idea what it was that they were looking for. They wanted something, quote, streetwise as far as this plant thing is concerned. A streetwise plant that comes from outer space, and he has two or three different personalities. He's a bit devious, nice and kind, sly and sneaky." He said the plant starts out sort of sweet and kind, then gets sly and devious and mean. I thought about it some. In the music business, you have quite a few people like that, so I put those people in my mind. Oh, so his character is actually based upon all of the people that he's dealt with working with the Four Tops in his entire career, that he put into this.
It's so juicy.
Likeable, but hateful, but yeah.
It makes me want to go watch it again. Like tonight.
Yeah.
Just knowing that.
Yeah. But that's the thing that convinced him to do this role. Because Frank Oz was like, "I really want you to do this." You know, like, you did two takes of it and you were immediately already, you know, the person that we had in mind. So right. He had to convince him, and then giving him that kind of character and that freedom and that license, he just took off with it.
He had a story that he wanted to tell.
Yeah.
And here, he found a vehicle for
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And Frank Oz was like, he actually was better when he stopped taking direction from me.
Right. That is, as a director, that is often the case. Not, like when somebody comes in, one, collaboration is fucking genius because you're inviting people into your world, but they come with stories that they want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody brings you something beautiful and rich like that,
yep.
like a lifetime of experience with characters who are very likable and duplicitous,
yes.
and who get what they want,
mm-hmm.
and they gift you that, he gifted him that.
Yeah.
And if you're a smart director, like Frank Oz is a pretty smart director, get out of the way. And let that happen.
Totally.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is one of the things where so much about directing or, like, making, producing is just casting. If you can right. get that cast and you can just kind of, like, jibe with one another. Wow. It's so great. I wanted to get into some of the production design as well. And so the production design was done by Roy Walker, who did a couple of tiny movies like Barry Lyndon and The Shining.
Right.
Just small right. things.
Right. Just not visual at all.
No,
nothing we remember.
Didn't like create worlds or anything.
Or images that stay with us for a lifetime.
So Roy Walker did the sets, and he built a complete New York street on the soundstage. It took them 3 months to turn the stages into an exact replica of their Skid Row in Manhattan. And that was an onerous process that they were so, so specific about.
You know?
It's what Frank Oz was saying is that they didn't want things to be too real. And they didn't want things to feel too melodrama fake. What they wanted was a heightened realism.
That's funny. That's what I felt as an 11. That's part of the music, Audrey 2,
mm-hmm.
and the visual impact of that movie is why I stayed and watched it again and again. And actually watching it last night, I watched it on my laptop
mm-hmm.
with headphones on because somebody else in the room didn't want to see it.
Yeah.
So I did that, and I was remembering, one, I was instantly transported back to the seat that I watched it in. Like, I can tell you what row I was in.
Yeah.
And the distance I was from the screen. And I remembered the impact of the, like, high gloss.
Yeah.
Of the world, like the rich, saturated, high gloss of the colors and the way that the film was on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't getting that off of my little laptop, but I re-experienced it.
I wish more people could see it in a theater, but I'm curious. Okay, so you did a musical show.
Yes.
So something about musicals lends itself to heightened realism, I would say. But what did you guys approach production design as?
Oh, yeah. No, it was like, you know, it's the CW, so pastel colors and really good lip gloss and hair and
Super
fun. Like, there's a ball gown that is amazing and lots of like swishy dancing. And yeah, we went in. We leaned in. Not only did we lean in, but also I should say that the showrunner, Eileen, and I went and watched old musicals, and it was part of the writing to go back and say, you know, we really want to reference this number from mm-hmm. Singing in the Rain, and we want to reference the making of it and have it not be exactly what you saw, but if you love Singing in the Rain, you'll see this number and you'll be like, oh yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about this movie, Little Shop of Horrors, is the fact that Frank Oz really, you know, he'd done the Muppet movies. He'd done musical things big before.
Yeah.
But he wanted to be extremely intimate with this movie, which is something that was the opposite of what they had been doing with musicals. So he said, quote, "I didn't want to balloon this thing into a musical War and Peace or even a big splashy 40s extravaganza.
Right.
There are no dizzying overhead crane shots, no irrelevant dance numbers, nothing to overwhelm what is basically the simple story of a boy, a girl, and a man-eating plant." So in his mind, he was pulling things back because there are no crane shots.
Oh.
There's a lot of close-ups. And that's, I think, something that really sets him apart. And he was saying, "The thing that I learned was the power of the close-up, because the close-up in a screen as big as the one that showed Little Shop, the close-up shows the absolute nuance of the feeling behind the face. And then I didn't realize when I did that. That was only my third film. First, Dark Crystal helping Jim, then my own film, Muppets Take Manhattan. I was still learning along the way, so those are the reasons why we had to have a new ending, because Howard and I both realized it without even Warner's telling us or David telling us, and we knew what we had to do, and we did the satisfying, happy ending." So he was saying that the close-ups that he did, the choices that he made in his creative thing to, like, get right into Audrey's face,
left him with the necessity of not killing her, because we loved her too much.
Yep.
Yeah. I agree.
I mean, yeah, it's a visual language that you're trying to...
And so in that way, he's not, you know what? He's not saying that he changed it for the audience. He's saying he discovered it as he made it.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful to me.
Do you feel like you've ever done this in your...
All the time. Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you're doing good work, you've done all your homework, you've come to it with your heart, right, out, and then as you're working... You're finding new things and it changes.
Do you remember any times that you've done this?
Oh, Lord, on the spot.
Yeah, I know.
Well, no, I mean, I'm thinking of A Quiet Little Marriage, where I didn't want to film. I had written that Mary Elizabeth's father dies, and then she sees him through a door, and then we cut to a nurse is comforting her in the elevator, and you just know from her, like, you know, like, it was distance.
Yeah.
And then I came to the day where we were supposed to shoot the scene, and one, the actress was bringing me everything, and two, it just felt like a big hole in the middle of the story where something very important was happening and I'd cut away.
Mm-hmm.
And so we shot it, the whole scene with her staying and coming to the door, and the nurse is there, and we shot that. The scene that was missing, we just decided to shoot.
So you just kind of wrote it on the fly, did some improvisations.
I mean, and it wasn't line heavy. It was her staying in the moment with her dead father instead of me nervous about that death cutting away and distancing the camera so that you didn't really have to experience it.
Yeah. It's a different thing once you choose your shot selections, once you figure out, because if someone is telling that story to you and their face is giving you something, you have to change it.
You have to change it. Right. And always, actually, for me, maybe like Frank Oz, the better choice is to go in, lean into it. Like, I could tell it in a wide, but if she's bringing me a close-up, move the camera closer.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. So we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to get into Rick Moranis, and we're going to get a little bit again into the production design, too, because there's a couple of things that I want to talk about and some other fun stuff. So we'll be right back.
The Greatest Generation is a Star Trek podcast that destigmatizes the very idea of having a Star Trek podcast.
We're Ben and Adam, the hosts of The Greatest Generation, and the technology we've developed is that nobody knows what you're playing in your earbuds.
You know, with legalization, it's easier than ever to find out what's in your buds. But we suggest that you legally find The Greatest Generation wherever you download your podcasts.
We'll send it to you in a discreet, unmarked package, and nobody has to know but us.
That's The Greatest Generation, the Star Trek podcast that you didn't know you needed, yet makes you feel like you belong.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Mo Perkins, and we're talking about Little Shop of Horrors. So, Rick Moranis, they knew that they wanted Rick Moranis after his performance in Ghostbusters pretty immediately. And Frank Oz said, or actually David Geffen said, I ran into him at a concert and said, you're going to star in my movie. He looked at me and I'm sure he went, ugh, Hollywood.
I like your Rick Moranis impression.
That's very good.
Then Frank Oz met with him, and Rick Moranis said, it was before Frank was involved, they asked me. And I met Frank and said, just because all these other guys want me in their picture doesn't mean you have to go. It's such an unusual role to be offered. And then Frank Oz was like, no, I definitely want you. Like, we all want you.
Yeah, and he's perfect.
Yeah, he ended up being great. He said that it was the first time that he really got to do straight acting. He had not gotten a chance to do that. I mean, he's kind of like the lovable, you know, kind of buffoony guy. And then SCTV, you know, he was doing Bob and Dave and all these other sketches. And it was just a different kind of thing. Whereas this, he's actually feeling emotion and he's like singing and he's, you know, looking to this woman's eyes and there's reciprocation.
He gets a full character arc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's not doing the parody that he was used to. And he was a bit nervous about that. But he also was just... Everyone was just so impressed with him and really enjoyed how, you know, kind of non-Hollywood he was. Aww. In the making of this film.
That's how you feel watching him.
Yeah.
He feels very genuine.
But then you pair him with Ellen Green. And Ellen Green originated the role on Broadway. And she was essentially the first actor who had originated a role on Broadway to get the film role. As well. She really didn't think that she was going to get it.
Yeah.
And so she was shocked because she wasn't a big name.
Yeah.
And, you know, something like this, they're like, yeah, of course, a name. But that woman is so many different things. She could play kind of like the shy, you know, like bemused, or she could just let her voice ring off the fucking wall.
Yeah.
She had such a strong presence, you know?
Yeah. It's a complicated role, too, because she is such a victim.
Yeah.
And she is resigned to her own victimhood.
Yeah.
Like, there's not even a struggle in her with her dysfunctional relationship, abusive relationship.
Yeah.
And yet, somehow, you still feel strength in her. I think she managed to bring something that maybe wasn't on the page to that character.
Yeah. It wasn't just she's weak or she's strong. She's something in between.
Yeah, she's multifaceted.
What?
What? It happened.
What?
I just said it.
But she was surprised that she got this role for a reason, and that is because we don't always cast the best singers, the best dancers in movies. What
or
we do.
The best actors, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, we're kind of casting people who have big social media presences, too, you know? Like, it's... It's a weird thing. Oh, she just cringed. You didn't get to see that.
No, don't. I don't want it. You know. It's just a mistake, that one.
Yeah.
If you cast somebody because they're going to tweet about the film, you might be shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should be thinking about...
You won't be making a good film.
Yeah.
And then no one will watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you worked with some unknown actors in your time that you feel like... doesn't matter where they came from, this is the person that needs to be in this role?
Oh, yeah, sure. And you always want that.
Yeah.
And there's a, like, I don't know, indie film, there's a balance. Like, people are trying to build something up that maybe doesn't have a lot of the support behind it that mm-hmm. other films do. And so they're looking for ways to get eyes and attention. And some of that is casting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a balance. If you don't make a good movie or you cast the wrong person, you will regret it.
One of my favorite parts of this movie is the street urchins is what they're called, which is the
women.
Three young ladies who are singing in their girl group.
Yeah.
And that is Tashina Arnold, Michelle Weeks, and Tisha Campbell. And
they're wonderful.
I love the things that the interviews that came out with them around the time, because they were like 16, 17, and 19 at the time.
Amazing.
They were so young, and even though some of them had been working a little bit in TVs and stuff, like this is their first big thing,
yeah.
All of them. And so it was huge. Of course, Tashina Arnold went on to work with Tisha Campbell on the show Martin. They'd had a kind of long career together. And all three of them had actually known each other before they got cast.
Yeah.
So the reason that they were cast, aside from all of them being so wonderful and had such great voices, is because they had a great chemistry together.
Because they felt like that group already.
They could have chosen like maybe some other people. They were like, these are the three that feel good together. And so it was just kind of a group casting that they did. And they were so surprised because they went everywhere. They went to London. They went to Australia. They went everywhere looking for these three roles. And they came back to Los Angeles. And I think Tisha Campbell had said that, I can't believe they came back to three girls from the hood. Like, we're right here. We were right here the whole time.
Right. That's funny because I did not know that story,
mm-hmm.
but that is exactly what you feel from that performance, that they are friends, that they're a cohesive group. And also it's kind of like they are given a job that is less than their talents.
Yeah.
Right? Like they're very like, here, you pop in and tell us how we should feel about blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And they just elevate it.
Well, one of the things that Frank Oz had to do is he had to pull them aside and say, you guys are so good, but you might be too good, and you're actually upstaging Steve Martin.
Yeah, yeah.
And I need you, like, I hate saying this, but I need to pull you back because you're upstaging Steve Martin. Because these three women were just like, they were just so amazing. They could have just had their own show.
And they become the movie. Like, gradually, they become more and more and lush in those, like, sparkly dresses on the top of the building. Like they kind of rock it as he does.
And they thought at first when they saw the movie, they were disappointed that they only went in and out of the movie, because in the stage version, the chorus is always there on the stage.
Oh.
So there's a little bit of a trade-off that they had, where if they were on the stage, they never would have been given full focus.
Right.
But in the movie, even though they're not on the stage all the time, they are given full focus when they
have their moments.
Yeah, when they've got their moments.
Yeah.
So it was a weird thing for them. But they were just so dynamic. And I'm curious, you know, if I could talk to you a little bit about maybe like an ensemble kind of cast, or like casting people because you're like, these two have the best chemistry, or maybe even they worked together before and they know each other. Has that happened with you before?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the last time you had fun, the four main characters are on screen together the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
It's just them. And definitely going into casting, you look at it like a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, you can't cast one human. You have to cast four.
So were you having them read all four together? Were you pairing them up?
I paired them up. But in my brain, I kind of knew, like, you have to balance the energy and it has to feel like this. And if you cast this role with this actor, it changes who you can balance them against.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely cast like that.
So, like, you've got the four, so it's got to be earth, wind, water, fire, right?
Every single time, yes.
Yeah. Do you ask them their zodiac signs? Like, I'm sorry, what are you?
No, but in my head, I have, like, a kind of a cheat sheet of, like, well, if this person brings this kind of acidic energy, then somebody has to be the base.
So the thing that we should maybe end on has to do with our plant.
Oh, plant.
I really love this fucking plant. Aside from just the voice, it was the biggest thing that anyone had ever done. It was, they had 15,000 handmade leaves.
Yeah.
And 11.5 miles of cable, slightly more than was used to build the Brooklyn Bridge.
Jesus.
And Frank Oz said, Size is the downfall of most mechanical marvels. The biggest tech breakthrough is the mechanical vines that we did. We approached the Atomic Energy Institute to do R&D on a core that wouldn't bend out of shape. The scientists there saw it as a game, a pleasant break from their top security work, and they came up with alternatives that could make an 8-foot vine with positive control.
Amazing. Yeah, and each of those little tentacles has a personality and gets in there on that scene. Interesting.
It's 18,000 handmade or 15,000 handmade leaves, 11.5. But the fact that they approached someone or a team of scientists from the Atomic Energy Institute is something that I found very fascinating because it wasn't something that someone suggested. It was just like, well, what if we did it? Like, they've got resources and tools, they've got knowledge. What if we just teamed up with them for this?
Yeah. I mean, well, he had the experience from Muppets and Dark Crystal. And he was like, I know the challenge. And now I have to make the big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
go get the experts.
Can we talk a little bit about the costumes, too? Apparently, every character, Mara Allen was the person who did the costumes, they said that every principal actor knew exactly what their style of their character would be. Alan says that he said that Green was very aware of what Audrey would dress like. Quote, she wanted clothes that suggested cast-offs from Kim Novak and Rita Hayworth. We agreed that there would be a point in the story where her image would change. When she falls in love with Seymour, she goes from red, black, and leopard to softer shades.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can see that's very clear within her costuming.
Yeah.
It's one of the, like, delicious and also problematic things that happens in the film where she is, there's that great line where she's talking about the ugly, dirty things that she wore in the gutter. And she's like, not tasteful things like this, but she's curvaceous and they're hugging the curves and they're working with it. Like, there's something wonderful about the way that she dresses in the beginning of the film because it's very, like, declarative and about just somebody claiming their femininity. And then as she gets kind of claimed by him in a weird way, she starts to hide her femininity and it's, like, white and pastel. And there's no more cleavage.
Yeah, it's like she got owned.
A little bit. That was part of the discovery of rewatching as a grown up was like, I loved her so much. And now I don't know if I'm ever going to show this to my 10-year-old daughter because it doesn't have the thing that I want to show her, which is maybe there's a third ending to Little Shop of Horrors, the like Audrey ending.
not the
married off and owned and not the fed to the plant, but the other ending. Where Audrey finally makes it.
Audrey opens up her own plant store.
Something.
You know, maybe Seymour dies and Audrey has to...
Audrey feeds Seymour to the plant. I don't want that either. But...
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I feel like I've flubbed it on my own stuff, but I just want to talk about this movie.
Well, when people want to watch I Ship It, what do they do?
They have to wait until August 19th, and then it is on Monday nights at 9:30 on the CW.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
But I'm dating a semi-sadist.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.